Welcome to Coffee with Kelly. This is the Crisis Go podcast, where we dive deep into the importance of school safety and explore ways to enhance safety practices in K-12 institutions. I'm your host, Ethan Woodman, product marketing specialist for Crisis Go. Our discussion is led by Crisis Go's safety analyst, Kelly Moore, who has an immense amount of firsthand experience helping schools improve their safety ecosystems. In this episode, we will be discussing key points related to school safety, including the importance of taking the first step, the need for standard policies and procedures, the value of active participation, seeking partnerships and resources, and creating a legacy of safety. Additionally, we will explore how to adopt a growth mindset, draw lessons from the U.S. Navy SEALs, employ critical thinking, develop effective plans and processes, and continually improve school safety practices. Our goal is to create a safe space for open discussions about school safety and encourage a culture of continuous learning and improvement. So grab your coffee, sit back, and join us in this essential conversation on school safety. Well, hello, Kelly.
Hello, Ethan.
How's your day going so far?
Good. It's started off a little crazy, but everything is leveling out.
It's better now that you're talking to me, right?
Of course.
So we are now on our episode 7 podcast, and today you are going to be starting off by talking about the importance of adopting a growth mindset in school safety.
Yes.
Why is that important, Kelly?
Well, we've talked about this before, right? It's where most of our educators didn't get into this, their profession, to be a safety expert, and they're reluctant to do that. But with anything new, any adventure we want to go on, any journey that we want to go on, especially in the education system, all they have to do is use their current models, what they're teaching our kids. Our kids come in to kindergarten not knowing much beyond maybe their ABCs and maybe how to count 1 to 10 or something, not much more than that. And we don't expect them the next day to learn algebra or to be able to graduate from high school the next day. We put them on this journey, and we want them to master one skill before they go on to the next skill. And that's kind of what our blog was about. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. That's what comes up when I start learning something new. You got to start. We talked about it in the last podcast and the last blogs in February. And that is, when you want to be adventurous, you want to learn a new skill, you got to be bold and take that first step. That's what we're talking about now, and building on that step.
This kind of relates to, you can have failures and setbacks, but we just, the whole point of changing our mindset is to see those as opportunities to learn from them.
Right.
Right. And improve our safety practices.
Right. So there's several things psychologically that occurs when we're learning something new, and there are huge barriers to our growth. One of them is this anxiety caused by failure. We don't want to fail in front of people. We put our teachers, our administrators up on a pedestal, thinking that they know everything. And so they take on that persona, and they have to take on that persona to be confident in what they're doing, that they know what they're talking about. But then we switch to another skill that they're required to have, as we've spoken about quite a bit in the last couple of months, where they don't have that confidence. They don't have those skills, abilities, experience. So now we have to start over again, and we have to remove those anxieties by saying, here we go, taking on that first step. And scaffolding, learn something very basic, then make it more complex the next time. And when we start doing that, and we cause that anxiety because they don't want people to see them fail. So let's create this environment, this safe environment, to be where we're all going to fail. at points, but let's learn from those failures. Let's not be so worried about failing that we don't learn. Your students have those same anxieties, those same stresses, fear of failing in front of other people. The kids that don't read so well, the ones that aren't so proficient in math, they have those same anxieties.
Yep.
What do you tell them to do? Let's work through this. Let's walk through this. We'll get it and you'll become confident. And as soon as you learn that new skill, whatever it is, you will become more confident. And that's all we're doing here, is looking at this long journey of becoming proficient in emergency processes, school safety, by starting at the beginning, taking that first step, reducing your anxiety, because we're all going to fail. And then we're all going to learn from those failures. That's all we're doing here. It's a pretty simple process. Not easy, but it's a pretty simple process.
It's funny when you brought up, you know, students, you know, that are struggling in a certain area. It's, you know, I was one of those students where math was very hard for me for some reason. I don't know why, but that's just how it was. And, you know, I definitely understand that, you know, you'd be in a classroom and, you know, the teacher would call on you to say, "Hey, what's the answer to this?" And like, I don't know. Cause, you know, all the other students would look at me like, "How do you not know that?" But it's funny because later on in life, I learned how to weld. And that was the time that I truly understood fractions. Before that, like, I struggled with it. But as soon as I like applied it to like an action and like making furniture, it like came so easily to me. I'm like, man, I wish I would have started welding when I was like like 6 or 7.
Right.
Maybe I would have done better.
Yeah. So I was dyslexic before that was really a thing. I grew up in the early 60s. People knew about dyslexia and other learning disabilities, and I had speech issues. I had had it. I still have dyslexia. I have some minor forms of OCD and ADD, but I learned through my own path that I had to learn things differently. You can sit there and talk to me. I can read something and I'm not going to understand it. But like you, if I participate in it and I apply it, I learn very quickly. And surprisingly, mathematics was very easy for me, because early on, I was exposed to like word puzzles and other types of puzzles and problems. And because I had to figure out how to learn differently than other kids did, I was far behind them most of my academic career. But when it came to math, it was like a puzzle to me. And I could figure out how to do that pretty quickly. So math was not an issue to me, but reading was. For far beyond my high school years, I had literally never read a complete book. I was probably 24 or 25 years old before I actually read a complete book from cover to cover, just to read it.
But you were good at math.
I was good at math. Problem solving.
I think those are two different sides of your brain.
I think that's part of why I excelled in emergency management.
I was going to say that I feel like that translates pretty well to your previous experience. So it's cool.
But it's a skill we all can learn. It's not, we might learn it differently, but one of the things that I also learned very young was failure was part of that learning process. And I wasn't in fear of failing because I knew I would learn. I kept trying and I kept after it and I figured it out. I figured out how it worked for me. I graduated, not at the top of my class, but I wasn't at the bottom either, right? So you can figure it out. And that's what we're really talking about here, right? Is having the ability to learn a new skill that, whether it's in paper or not, the expectation, like we talked about in the last blog, the expectation is that you're going to keep my kids safe. Now we have to figure out how to do that. And that's what we're really talking about here.
One of the, I think this is one of the skills that you mentioned. I think it's probably one of the most important, was critical thinking. To have the ability to just critically think about everything that's going on around you. And you note that it is a perishable skill. And so in this case, it's, you know, when you attain the ability to think critically, it may not be, you know, like riding a bike. So maybe let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So critical thinking is helpful in all aspects of your life. When you're buying a car, what are they selling me, right? Taking the perspective of the salesman, taking the perspective of the manufacturers, taking the perspective of you as a customer from your perspective. And it's looking at all these different perspectives and trying to put them together to figure out what the truth is for you in this transaction. The ability to look at things from different perspectives is really what critical thinking is about. What does this mean? What is the impact? How am I going to apply this? What are the obstacles and challenges? And how do I work through this problem? And you have to critically think about that. You have to look through all of these different perspectives. If you don't do that, then you stop thinking about other perspectives, or you forget about this perspective. When I talked about infusing safety into everything that we do, when we talked about building a safety culture in your school, what we're really talking about is critically think about everything that you're doing and how it impacts safety. So what I'm asking you to do is talk about new curriculum. This is a favorite of mine, because most of the time our curriculum is viewed as being safe in the safety discussion. But is it? How is our curriculum impacting the safety of our students? Most people would say, Kelly, what are you talking about? Well, one of the biggest discussions that we're having right now in the realm of safety is emotional well-being and mental health. How is that impacting our emotional well-being and mental health? The curriculum. I can't answer that. I don't know what curriculum you're talking about, but there's every curriculum adds stress, adds anxiety. And if we don't address that, then we have a negative impact. So let's start thinking about that.
Because if, let's say, a student is impacted negatively mentally, it could set them on the path to violence.
Sure.
Right?
Yep. Yeah, it deals with their coping, their ability to cope, right? And their coping skills. If they're impacted, they're depressed, they have anxiety, they have fear of things, whatever that might be, they're not thinking about how do I cope with this? What are my coping skills? How do I work through this? They're not thinking that. They're overwhelmed by it. That's why they're anxious, depressed, and in fears. They're overwhelmed by this. So now if I have another problem that I have to deal with, I'm going to deal with it from this stressed out, mentally challenged state, and I'm not necessarily going to make the best decisions.
So in the blog here, you reference the U.S. Navy SEALs. Mm-hmm. So how can we relate? How can we possibly relate such a prestigious group to the professionals in the K-12 environment that have a pretty different role.
Yeah. So we're talking about one of the most elite military units on the planet, right?
Yeah.
It's not what their mission is or their goal is, but how do we look at what it is that they can bring to our world that can help us? And there's several things that they teach and they infuse in their soldiers, their warriors, whatever you call them, their SEALs, from the very beginning. And that's to be mentally strong. Your body can do much more than most of us believe it can. We're limited by our mental well-being. So they start chipping away at that pretty early in their training. First of all, they start saying things like, we never lose. We either win or we learn. And so most of us in the civilian world would look at it and say, you either win or you lose. They're looking at that loss, what we would consider a loss, and flipping it around and say, that's where we're learning. And we talked about this a couple of blogs ago about process improvement. So they're always in a process of improvement, because if something didn't go correct, an operation, a training exercise, an evolution is what they call those. If that doesn't go as planned, what did you learn from that? How are you going to correct that? How are you going to implement it so that you never do that again? And we look at that when we talk to our teachers and our faculty and our administrators, and they say, that's not my job. I can't do that. I didn't get in here to do this job. Well, you did. You just didn't realize it. You didn't understand the whole breadth of your responsibilities. So how do we do that? How do we make what your weaknesses are and make them strengths? Your weakness is, I don't know how to do that. That's not my job. How do we turn that into your strength? You turn around and say, I don't know how to do that, but it is my job, and now I need to move forward. So I take a lot of inspiration from military units, from some movies, so forth. But when I'm thinking about, when I'm watching a movie and I'm watching the movie, I'm looking at things within that movie that send a positive message that I can bring to the safety realm, the school safety realm, and say, okay, how does this help? And does it apply? How does it apply? Because what I'm doing all of the time, and I'm trying to make myself better here, I'm trying to make my strengths stronger and my weaknesses my strengths. And that's all from this military edict of win or learn, weakness into strengths.
So I was interested, as you were talking about that, basically K-12 professionals or teachers understanding their roles, and I was kind of interested. I'm like, you know, is that presented in like the initial, like if you're going to apply to be a teacher, is it in the application? And I've been kind of walking through these, and you know, nowhere in the responsibilities of this one that I'm looking at has anything to do with safety. So that makes me ask, it should start there as well, right?
Yes.
You know, because they're applying for these jobs, and there's not even that initial understanding.
We've talked a little bit about this in a different context, in what are our expectations. So we talked about that in the last podcast, I believe, maybe the one before that. But what are our expectations and our responsibilities? We've also talked about the watershed moment for everyone in school safety of the Columbine tragedy, April 20th of 1999.
Yeah, that one locked in, didn't you?
Yep. It's coming up, right? We are a little more than a month away of the 24th anniversary.
That's crazy.
And yet we still don't have that as part of one of the minimum qualifications of our teachers. Remember when I said infuse it in everything you do? Why not inform them that they are responsible for the safety and care of their students and every student on campus? You set the expectation. They understand the responsibility because they read it. They applied for the job. Why isn't it on the job application? Why are we not teaching this at the university level or the certification level to get that job, to qualify for that job? We're 24 years away from what most people refer to as the watershed moment for school safety.
And that's not even, it's not like that was the only time. So it's not like we have an excuse of, oh, I just forgot about it.
Right.
It's happening, and it's happening statistically more often.
I'm not sure we have gone an entire year. I don't know the answer to this, but I'm pretty sure we have not gone through an entire year without some act of school violence that made the national news since that time. And that may be inclusive of the pandemic years.
Yes, I think I was researching this before, and the statistics around that definitely went up during the pandemic, for sure. And that plays into what we were just talking about with kind of around the mental aspects of, you know, if they had asked that question of what is this doing for my school safety when we decided to do remote learning, what does that do mentally to our students?
What's the impact?
Unfortunately, saw the negative impact.
We're still experiencing them.
Yep.
That'll be a fun puzzle to solve, put together.
Yeah.
We lost a year and a half, 2 years of natural developmental processes for kids.
Yep. And for a lot of them, it was right at a pivotal moment of a lot of learning that they missed out on.
And we've gotten to a position where we rely so much on our schools to provide basic needs for our kids.
Yeah, that's one thing I honestly tend to forget about, is that there's needs other than just the teaching aspects that they were missing out on.
Well, that was a big part of the response was, how do I make sure that these kids get fed? How do I make sure that they're clothed, that they're safe at home? A lot of our kids aren't safe at home. They come to school to be safe. At least they're safer at school than they are at home.
It's very sad to think about, for sure.
It is. Yeah, it is. But it's reality. And we look at all of the basic needs that are being met, and we put lots and lots of money into meeting those basic needs. But again, we also talked about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And one of the very basic is that need to feel secure. And we're not providing that, or we're not doing as good a job as we should be.
So within the blog, you talk about the need for a standard set of policies, procedures, safety protocols, all that, and that everyone is learning the same material. So could it be possible that a teacher could go and individually make a plan for their own classroom in terms of safety procedures, or should they solely rely on their safety team to make those plans? How does that all work?
Yeah, so that's part of the process. So we look at the hierarchy or the structure of the schools, right? So you have the district level where they create and develop policies around everything that the schools do, including safety. That gets passed down to the next level. And the next level starts putting the structure to that, whatever that safety policy is. As an example, you shall, in California, you shall have a comprehensive school safety plan that is reviewed and approved every year by March 1st. So that's the policy. That's the mandate from the state of California. It doesn't say that you have to have this plan done or this one. It says you have to have a comprehensive school safety plan. And it gives you some guidelines. But then it gets passed down to the next level, whatever that is for your school district. And they decide what that means. Your safety, your district level safety team is a good place for that to occur. What is a school safety, comprehensive school safety plan? What does that look like? Then it gets pushed down to the next level. We have this comprehensive school safety plan structure. What does that mean to your school? So the principals and the individual school safety teams start interpreting that as to what it means for their school. And then it gets pushed down to the next level, the teacher. What does this plan mean for your classroom and your students? If I call a lockout, where are you going in your classroom? If I call a lockdown, how are you going to protect, secure the room and protect the students in there from being seen? If somebody breaches your door, how are you going to protect yourself and your students from that person who breached your door? That's where the individual teacher is responsible for their plans. The plan for their environment that was set, the parameters were set at the district level and then again at the building level, but they're all the same. They're different, but they're the same. When I call a lockdown, everyone knows what the expectation of that is. As the I Love You Guys Foundation likes to say, lockdown locks lights out of sight. That's the same for every staff member in that district. Each teacher has to determine what that actually means and how they're going to accomplish that at or in their classroom. A lot of classrooms have like a supply closet. They're connected, but they have like a supply closet or a bathroom or something that connects the two rooms. But when they do that, those rooms are, the floor plans within the rooms are flip-flopped. So those two are going, one's going to go left and the other one's going to go right. You have to understand that, right?
It's probably, you know, again, important for your community members like police and fire to also know the layout of your rooms.
Sure.
As we've previously discussed as well.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that's all part of it, right? Is how do you communicate that? We talked about bringing your partners in, your first responder partners. They're going to help you critically think through that because they're going to help you think from their perspective. And you're going to help them critically think through your processes. What does it mean to you? What does it mean to the fire departments? What does it mean to the police department? And they're going to help you develop those plans because they're going to say, yeah, I understand where you're going with this, but that doesn't help us at all because we're going to do this. And our primary objective when we get this type of call is this. What are you doing and what support do you need while we're accomplishing our primary objectives, right? We're bringing in different first responders because they have different skill sets. They bring a part of the total solution, a specific part of the solution, they bring that to the table. But they're doing that and you're calling them in because nobody else can do that part. That's where your this whole process comes in, your critical thinking. if you've never driven a police car and responded to a call or a large-scale emergency like this, it's hard to get that perspective. Not saying you couldn't do it, but it'd be hard for you to get through that to that perspective. So you need to bring them in. They're going to help. They're going to think critically from their perspective, and they're going to start asking you questions that you didn't think about because you're working from your perspective and not theirs. So everyone's going to start thinking critically together. They're going to start developing those plans and implementing those plans and participating in the process improvements and things like that that we've already talked about. You know, they're going to engage your problem-solving skills and your critical thinking. They're going to say, okay, we've got that scenario worked out. What about this one? And you're going to have to go through that process again. Maybe that next process is a little bit more complex. And then you start building on it, and scaffolding is what I like to call that. Your learning.
There's always going to be a new and different, you know, situation or whatever that you're going to have to build to respond to. So it's continuous learning.
Yeah. I think we've talked about this before. I'm not 100% on this, but one of the big faults of what we do in preparing for these active violent situations is we look at the last one and we start looking at what could we do to prevent that from happening again? Or if we decide, well, that we couldn't have prevented that one, how would we respond to that one? And we use the last incident to train for the next incident. Next one is completely different, right? There's a lot of characteristics that are the same, but the next one's not going to be at the same school. I'm not aware of a single school that has had multiple acts of violence. It could be out there, but I'm not aware of one. So these are all one-offs. So what is really our objective? Our objective is to understand the general overarching principles of school safety so that we can use what we learn, we can recognize danger and how to respond to that in any situation, not just the one that happened last time. Because if we're training for the one we did last time, we're setting up an unrealistic expectation that that's what it's going to look like next time. And the lessons we're learning and the tactics that we are learning are really meant to help you understand the type of event in its general presentation, not a specific presentation. We train in law enforcement how to respond to an active burglary, an armed burglary, a bank takeover. We do it roughly the same every time, but we also know there's a set of general objectives that need to be met. And those objectives apply to every one of those responses, not just the one down on Main Street.
Right. One of the points that you bring up that I think is maybe interesting to talk about is legacy. Now you hear this kind of talked about all over the place of, you know, I wanna leave my legacy. You know, what happens after you leave this earth? You know, what's left? And you know, there's a lot of people who care a lot about that. So what's, in terms of legacy, how do we apply that to school safety?
Well, I mean, you have to look and examine yourself, right? And explain to yourself, determine for yourself what you want people to remember you for. Do they remember you for being a fun guy, easy to talk to? That's your legacy. Or do you want something, what I consider bigger than that, something that will be around, your impression will be around for generations. You left your mark on society, hopefully for the better. I retired from law enforcement almost 5 years ago. I had a lot of positive impacts on a lot of people's lives. I had a lot of negative impacts on people's lives because of the primary function of my job. When I retired, and just prior to my retirement, I was having more positive impacts than negative. But I still wasn't really done with wanting to help people, wanting to protect my community, wanting to make my communities safer. So then that's when I started looking at school safety as a way to leave my impact for a longer period of time, to create a stronger legacy for Kelly. Is how can I help my community the most, the best? And that's taking my experience and translating it to, or transferring it to, the general public, the schools, the communities, help them understand how to be safer. That's one of the reasons I work at Crisis Go, is I took what I was doing and was a fairly successful. Can't say I was 100% successful there, but I thought I was fairly successful and had a huge impact on my community and my schools when I was the school safety coordinator. People still know who I am. I still get calls on a fairly regular basis from principals at that school district asking, Kelly, how do you do this? Can you help us? So that to me is part of my legacy. Coming into Crisis Go, now I'm helping more schools in more communities across the nation, really, whether it's directly by talking to them and helping them get their emergency programs, their safety programs headed down the right path, like we're doing on these podcasts, or indirectly by making sure what we produce and what we sell is applicable to that endeavor. So that's what I did. So that's what I'm doing now. You have to decide for yourself what you want your legacy to be and strive for that. And sometimes our legacies that we leave ultimately are not necessarily under our control, because it's how we respond to something.
That's a great point.
It's how we react to something, how well we did something, how poorly we did something. So I can sit down and map out my entire, what I want people to think of as my legacy. I can do that. I think people should do that. But when all is said and done, it's your actions, and oftentimes your inactions, that actually determine what your legacy is. And if you can control your actions and what you do and how well you do it, you have a much better chance at controlling your legacy. All I have to say to kind of drive that point home is you can look at all of the different administrators in every school emergency, whether it's an act of violence or tornado or a riot or whatever the emergency is. And they have created their legacy. Many of them did it correctly and responded correctly. And now they're looked to as having this fantastic legacy. Others wanted that legacy, but they failed to put in the work beforehand. And now you're looking at them and you're going, what were you thinking? Why did you do that? Why didn't you do this? And that's where their legacy is from. That's not what they wanted. That's not how they designed it. But they didn't put in the work. They just said, I want to be chief of police, or I want to be the superintendent. You got there, but you didn't put in the work to establish the ability to respond and control this emergency the way that you needed to. And that's going to be your legacy.
Definitely a lot to think about on that one. You know, I think it's also important. I mean, it's not only is it a legacy that's people that are using to kind of like judge you in a way, or, you know, this person implemented this, or this person was great because they did this, or they weren't great because they didn't do this. It's a big part of it is teaching the next generation. And that's, I think, a big reason why you see people going into those fields of being a teacher, is they love teaching the next generation. And I think a big part of that is you got to teach part of this kind of safety culture too. And if we're doing that, they're going to take that information and apply it to their lives. And over time, we're going to start seeing the school safety culture be more equipped, more knowledgeable, and hopefully overall just better.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that we're going to look at, in every situation, when we're talking about legacy, the same situations has both groups of people. People who did things correctly and people who did not. So we're creating both types of legacies. Actually, the third type is somewhere in the middle, right? You have the two extremes. They did everything correctly. They didn't do it correctly. And then the people who just kind of survived it. But in every incident, we have those legacies being created. I think people do get into education as a profession for very pure reasons. I think they do. And I'm not trying to bash them down. And I applaud them. That's something that I don't have the patience for, and I would probably fail miserably at. But we also have to realize that the reason that they got in, their primary mission going into education, is not their only mission. And that's where we start talking about our safety culture. This is also part of your responsibility. It's a huge one. You may not like it, but it's part of what you signed up for, whether you knew it or not. And I think we have to start looking about challenging people and trying to give better understanding of expectations, responsibilities, so that they take it upon themselves to actively participate in their safety and the safety of those kids that they're in charge of. It's not a super difficult task. It just takes some time and effort.
As does basically any other function. Everything requires some amount of effort.
Correct. Yeah. And you look at me, I'm a dyslexic kid. ADD, OCD. I have all these different wonderful attributes that people always want to have. But I did it. It's not that difficult. It's not that complex. We just have to practice it. Shooting a basketball is not difficult. It's not complex. We just have to practice it. Golfing, not that complex. It is if you try to perfect your swing or to make it look like exactly like the professionals the first day.
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Right. And there is no perfect swing. Everybody's body, their mechanics are different. There's a perfect swing for you, but there's not a single perfect swing in golf because everyone is different. I can tell you what you need to do to hit the ball straight, but you're going to have to come at that from your perspective. You're going to have to practice it. You're going to have to make the adjustments, and you're going to have to figure a way to make it perfect for you. I can't play golf anymore because I'm old and my knees are shot, but I could not figure out how to correct my slice. I didn't practice enough. I get it. But I did make an adjustment that allowed me to start lowering my score. I accepted that I was going to have a slice on every hit. So I aimed to the left of my target. Everyone would say that that is not the way to do it. But it worked for me. It was perfect for me.
If it works, it works, I guess.
That's right. Be creative.
I used to be the worst player on my soccer team when I was much younger. I was the least skilled. I was the slowest. It was just all around the worst player. And I went from being the worst player for a few years. And it wasn't until the last year of middle school that I ended up actually being one of the best players on the soccer team almost consistently throughout high school in terms of skill and speed and accuracy of my shots. And it's all because I just worked my butt off and I practiced almost every day.
Yeah. So when we look at the professional level, we look at that as the gold standard. And we look at those people who are playing professional football, baseball, soccer, hockey, whatever. And we look at them and say, wow, that guy's got talent. That's a talented guy. What we forget about is they are 25 years old and they've been playing since they were six. They've been working on that skill for, do the math real quick, 19 years.
Yeah. Long time.
Right? And they outworked everybody. You look and you talk to these people. Some of them were talented, no doubt about it. It was easier for them. But you talk to coaches and they would rather somebody who put in the work than somebody who was talented. Somebody who outworks. I see it almost every day on an interview, a sports interview, a hockey interview. I'm a big hockey guy. I love hockey. But when you talk to them, they said, yeah, we have to outwork them. They didn't say we're much more talented. And we've seen teams in sports, lots of sports, almost every sport, where they had all the talent, but they still lost. People relied on the talent. And you have these teams that are just outworking them every time they outwork them. And it's the people who outwork or that are going to be successful.
I know exactly what you mean, because there was, you know, I'd obviously play in rec leagues and stuff. And, you know, there was definitely some times where, you know, my team would say, oh, this other team isn't, they're not as good as we are. And I would be one of the first people to say, okay, but that doesn't really matter, because if they want that ball more than you do, they're going to get it. If they want to win this game more than you do, it's going to happen. So don't forget that.
Right. Yeah. My son, both my kids were pretty good athletes. My son was very good. He was very athletic. Water polo player, goalie, Division I. And he was constantly on a team that underperformed. Probably to this day, I lost track with the water polo world, which is very small. But they had one of the most talented collection of talented water polo players ever. But they all knew it. And they all underperformed. They thought, I am so-and-so. I should get this. I should be able to do this. You should be able to, but that little kid over there outworked you. So we're going to take him.
Well, Kelly, I think we're pretty much done. Hopefully this episode has been informative for our listeners. I think it has. I've really enjoyed it, as I always do. And I don't think you've done this before, but maybe let's try this. Can you give like a little teaser of what our next podcast will be about?
So next month, we are going to start talking about mechanics. So we're really going to start looking at drills and exercises, situational awareness. We're going to start looking at the emergency response and management cycle. So the life of an emergency. So you can start looking at things that you can start planning for and start training for, exercising, why we do that and so forth. So, and finally, we're going to talk about what you do after the alarm sounds. So this will get into a little bit of the discussion of the current status of like panic buttons and why they're not the solution. But you have to ask yourself the question of what's next. So we'll have a lot to talk about. There'll be a lot of probably some controversy in what I say. And it's really meant to be controversial and to get you to start thinking. So but we're going to start getting into the nuts, the nuts and bolts. So we're going to start looking at building your knowledge and your skill sets and so forth. So that's what we're going to do next month.
Very cool. I'm excited. As we wrap up our discussion on school safety, we hope that this episode has provided valuable insights and sparked meaningful conversations around enhancing safety practices in your school. We encourage our listeners to take the first step towards improving school safety, whether that's by joining the school safety team, seeking out partnerships and resources, or actively participating in safety protocols. Remember that creating a culture of safety is an ongoing process that requires continuous improvement and a growth mindset. By working together, we can make our school safer for everyone. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast and hit that notification bell to know when our next podcast is available. We encourage you to leave a comment on what was your favorite part about this podcast on our website at crisisgo.com. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Coffee with Kelly, a discussion on school safety.